Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Just present myself. I am Roland Maxelaire. I'm in charge of two speakers.
Two or three?
Three, but the last one, I don't have the confirmation. Certainly, on your program, you have two teachers. One is Laurent Ledoux, that is here today. And the second one is Jean-François Nobel, who is going to come the 15th of December. Then that's the two I'm in charge with. I'm very pleased to be here with you. I know that somebody asked me to pass the this piece of paper and you write your name on it, just to be sure that everybody is there. Then this one. Okay. And before we start, I would like to, that's a very old habit of me, is just to take the time just to breathe for 2 minutes. Then the best thing to do is to close your computer. You close your computer, you sit very well on your chair, and you take 2 minutes just to breathe. The reason for that is just to be sure that for the two next hour you will be really present in the room. You will try to forget where you come from and where you go. And just to be here for 2 hours. I will close my eyes, but you do whatever you want, but you just breathe and you just in at your breathing. Okay? Okay, then let's start. Laurent, the floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Hello, everybody. My name is Laurent Ledoux. So I've been, for the last years, the president of the Ministry of Transport in Belgium. And before that, I managed several companies. Today, I accompany companies who want to transform themselves into what we call liberating organizations or self-governing organizations. So I will tell you about my experience and basically about leadership. So before we start, I would like you just to think for a few seconds about what you want to learn from this afternoon, from this course. So if you could just tell me with a few words what you expect to learn about, let's say, leadership and managing organizations differently. Is it possible? So, I don't know, maybe we can go at random, but I would like to hear it from all of you, what you really expect, and I will note it down so that we try to cover and meet all your expectations. Who wants to start? Yes?
I'm always curious about obstacles you face.
Okay.
So, like, real examples on how you overcame.
Okay, good. Obstacles. Yes.
So how you became aware of your leadership style,
okay,
and how, if this conflicts with other styles, how you dealt with it.
Excellent. Awareness, yes. Yes?
How to build a business case for a particular idea you have.
A business case? Okay, yeah. Okay. Yes.
How's your relation with experimentation and failure?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Next one.
how you convince people who didn't believe in your idea or work around them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, convincing or around. Yes, excellent questions.
Yes.
Why you're different?
Why am I different?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well.
Yes. Public and private interaction.
Can you say that again?
Public and private interaction.
Public and private interaction. Yeah. You mean like public organizations?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
What's your question really about it?
It's just because you said you work with the Ministry of Transport.
Yeah.
If I understand correctly, yeah. So there's a lot of interaction within that public sector, and then this whole interaction with the private sector. So
yes. But what's your question about it? What would you like to know?
Yeah. How did you manage to
Work with the two?
To mix
with
the two? Yeah.
To work with the two? Yes. Okay. Okay. Good.
In a good way. I guess.
Yeah. Okay.
Next one.
Everybody should speak, I guess.
What's your personal driver?
I'm driver, yeah. Okay. Yes?
What has been the outcome of this different way of
doing it? Okay. So, yeah. No?
What picked you up the moments you thought of giving up and stopping what you were doing?
Okay, giving up and
getting better.
Yes. And back. Okay. Yes.
Outside, you see yourself as a leader, and what you're doing. Okay.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes.
As you have worked on. Entreprise
Libérée,
can any enterprise be,
freedom for all, basically. Yes? Yes?
What's your biggest fear of the nightmare scenario?
about my life or about... Okay. Yes? Yes? The issue of time, yes. Exactly. Yes?
How do you think you have the most impact, or where do you think that you have the most impact?
Impact, yeah. All right. All good questions. We will need more than 2 hours. Okay, yes?
What makes you a change maker over just a leader?
Change maker, leader, manager. What's all this? Yes. Okay. Yes.
Different type of leadership between public and private organizations.
Okay, yeah. Basically, yeah, we come back. Okay.
What is the best way to enable more collaboration?
Okay. More collaboration. Yeah. Yes? Yes?
How can a company manage with more freely can be efficient?
So if you're more free, can you be more efficient? Is that, yeah? Mm. Okay. Efficiency of all this, yeah. Okay. We didn't speak yet.
I know how you became a leader.
Did I? Yeah, that's the question, really. Did I, did I, or am I don't know. Okay.
Yes. What's your vision of future of employment?
Future of employment? You have 2 questions, right? Future of employment, yes. Okay, what else? Well, yes.
How do you decide, like, when you have a project and it went well, you say, okay, now that went well, I move on something new.
Moving on to something else, yes. Yes. I can say who didn't speak yet, I can tell you that. Yes?
How you combine top-down and bottom-up?
Okay.
combining, yes. Okay. You can repeat a question if it's yours, and even if it's on the board, it doesn't matter.
Would change anything from what you've done so far? What would change from anything that you've done so far? What would change if you had to change something?
Ah, so my regrets or what I would like to change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Your biggest piece of advice for us?
Biggest piece of advice. Okay. Those who did, I want to hear the voice of everybody. Yes.
To what extent are companies receptive to your new ideas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Reception. Yes. Yes.
How to defy conventions? To be unconventional.
Defy conventions. Yes. Challenge conventions. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Understand a different type of leadership. So how to differentiate them?
Okay. So basically, here, what's a leader? And okay, the next one.
For me, it would be the difference between public and private leadership.
Okay. So we covered that already. You said already something. You didn't, right? Do you have to be a leader to be an impact?
To have an impact?
Okay. Yes, okay, it's the question of impact and leader. Basically, it revolves around the idea of leadership. What is it? And yes.
You have to be passionate about the subject to come really convinced.
Passion, yes. To convince, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Passion. Need it. Oops. Yes. Yeah.
Is humility a key driver for you?
Ah, yes. Good one. I guess you know the answer already. Yes.
With whom or with what kind of people do you need to work to have an impact?
Okay. What kind of people? Human beings. Yes. We didn't speak yet, we did that, right?
How do you manage work-life balance?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gosh, really? Work-life balance. Yes.
What did you need to sacrifice to your life?
Sacrifice. Okay, good. They're all good questions, huh? Yes. Yes.
What is it to empower? Like, how do you empower others, and is that part of being a leader?
Okay, empowering. Yes. Okay. Yes.
How do you communicate with your team?
Communication. Yes. Yes.
What makes you happy?
You're getting personal there. Yeah, my color is blue.
So, did you make choices?
Oh, do I make choices?
How do you make them?
How do I make them?
Decision-making process.
Okay, the type of decision-making process. Okay. Yes. Decision-making, yes. Yes. Did think you're looking for a question?
I don't.
No. So, what is your question?
I did not priority the decision-making process. How
priority?
Priority your
to prioritize. Yeah. Okay. Wow. It's going to be a huge course, huh?
It's kind of up there already, but I'd like to know the balance of supporters and challenges you keep around you.
Okay, yes, that's a good one. Yes. Balance between challengers and supporters. Yes, excellent. Yes, you did, huh? Yes, you did too. You did too. You did too. You. Yes, you did. My children.
Does anyone have this time?
Yes.
You?
No,
you did.
You did.
No.
No.
Why did you decide to stay in Belgium and not grow internationally?
I'm growing internationally.
You've always lived in Belgium.
I've lived in many countries, but...
then my question is answered.
No, I worked in more than 10 countries. I speak 8 languages. And I love being international, but so far, my family is in Belgium and we might move, but... Yes. You did already?
Yeah.
No.
Inspire your people and improve your learning curve.
Inspiration, yeah. Good.
Yeah.
And you did? So you're working on an important assignment, right?
You don't know me?
Yeah.
not really.
So, what is your question?
Yeah, I don't have one. Sorry.
Just find one.
I don't know.
Then maybe leave.
No, sorry.
No, it's okay. Just find one. We're waiting.
Okay. How are you?
I'm fine. That's a good one. Okay, thank you, everybody, for your input. We have quite a lot to cover. I will try to cover most of it. And in order to do so, we will start with a video. 2 minutes. It's in Hindi. Anybody who speaks Hindi? Yeah, good. So you'll tell us if they are bullshitting us. But you don't need to understand Hindi to understand the video. I want you to watch this video very carefully because it's a very, very important one. It tells us a lot of things about leadership and mobilizing people. Okay? So just watch it and then we'll discuss what you have seen in this video. And by doing this, we will answer quite a lot of your questions already. So, hold on, it's gone. Where, how do I do? Okay, still there. Yeah, go. It's back, yes.
Il faut enlever
HEC. Comment est-ce qu'on fait ça?
Le petit truc rouge.
Oh gosh, it's coming back. It will keep coming back? Maybe not.
Vous entendez?
सर आपके लिए उस पार कार का इंतजाम किया है सर आइए सर ए चल चल
क्या बात है सर क्या
ऊपर चला क्या ऊपर चला जा कुछ करो ना
मैं वहां जाके क्या उखाड़ लूंगा
जाने बूंदे आए जाने कैसा दर्द लाए सामने क्या है ये तेरे क्यों रुका है तू बता दे कौन तुझको पार लेगा कौन होगा वो मसीहा जिसे तू ढूंढता है वो ही है तू चलता है तुझ में तेरा है सहारा तू ही तुझको पार लेगा तू ही है तेरा किनारा किस
This is it. So, can you translate a little bit?
No, but I mean, did they say anything special that we should know of?
It's a common scene. I mean, especially it reminded me of my home.
Yes.
It's a lot. There's always traffic.
Yes.
And there's a, as all of you can see, there's a fallen tree, there's traffic jam.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, it's about getting the tree off the road.
Yes. Yeah, well, you don't need to tell the story. I think we got it. Thank you. Any other comment you would like to add on what they said that we didn't?
You're the one that you're trying to find. That's what it's, the song.
The song. So tell us about the song.
Yeah, you're the one that you're the person that you're trying to find.
All right.
You're the leader yourself.
Excellent. I didn't know that.
Finding the leader within you.
All right. Great. I didn't know it was about... I thought maybe it's a love song or whatever, but no. Okay, excellent. Okay, let me find now the PowerPoint. Where is it exactly, Roland? It's just that...
You see why I am here.
Okay, date de modification, wait. Yes, probably this one. Yes, all right, here it is. So, okay, so what did you see and what does it tell you about leadership? What have you seen in this video that strikes you and that you find interesting? Yes.
I found interesting the fact that you cannot be a leader by yourself. Like, you will not, even if you're a leader, you will not accomplish anything if you're not able to create a movement.
Yes. It's a good one. What else? Sorry.
You don't have to tell people what to do.
Yeah, excellent. Because he doesn't say a word. Doesn't say a word. Yes.
For example, that a leader cannot do anything without the support of the people.
Of the others. That's basically the same. Yes? Sorry. Sorry.
The importance of the first followers. Like the
first. Yes. The first mover. Yes. You had something.
Yeah, it's about inspiration, right?
Yes,
it's all about inspiring others to.
And how does he inspire?
By making the first move and by
is
showing.
Is it just that? Just think about this. Is it just by making the first move? Sorry.
It's the fact that even the smallest one can make a difference.
Yes. Yes.
My point was age doesn't matter.
Age doesn't matter. Yes.
He's trying to say, like, you need to do what you're asking of other people.
Yeah.
For true
leadership. Leading by example.
Yeah.
Yes. Sorry.
I was going to say leading by example and also with humility.
With humility. Yes. Where do you see humility in his?
Because he realizes that he cannot do alone, but he tries to give the example, but to act, to be pragmatic, and then he welcomes the others.
Yes. Other signs of humility of this little boy?
Not, they don't just start doing, but persist.
Yeah. Okay. We see also at other parts, we see some humility from him.
He didn't care about the rain.
He didn't care about the rain, indeed. Why is that important? What?
He didn't care about getting wet of his clothes or just being in the.
Okay.
The
okay. Yes?
Like, nobody asked him to do it, he just felt like...
Just, yes, indeed.
What's inspiring is that it's impossible for him to achieve anything the way he did it by himself, but he still did it. Like, it must have looked like an impossible task, like very brave in a way.
No, when you say inspiration, you said inspiration, but imagine it would not have been a small boy, but Arnold Schwarzenegger. Would it have had the same impact on other people? So, what is very interesting about this inspiration act, it's because it's absurd that it shocks people. So it's the symbol of what he does, which is more important than the act itself. Yes?
I think it's really that he will make the people actually they would feel bad because they think if a small kid is going to try to move the tree, if
yeah.
I don't, when I'm stronger and older.
But do you think people move just because they think
yes.
they would feel bad?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's in the car that there's
yes.
a woman who's pushing
yes.
her husband to go. So
yes.
it's kind of you should go.
You should go.
You
yes,
should.
Indeed. Yes. Yes.
Most people probably don't think it's possible, even when they join. It's more just out of solidarity and
maybe,
almost.
Maybe, indeed. I didn't think about it. Yes. So you see, there is a lot. But let me come to the core idea, I believe. What is the problem of this group?
Well, I think it just... they're so used to like some sort of system that fixes things for them.
Yes.
They don't even think outside of the box. Well, maybe we can just all together go there and move the tree. They're just like, oh no, again, this is happening. Like, there's no system, everything is rotten. But they just don't think themselves, oh, what can I do about it?
Yes, this, yes.
There's no coordination.
There is
they're
no
coordination. Living their lives in the
yes. But fundamentally, you're right, but what you say is fundamental. A lot of people, when I ask this question, they tell me, the tree is the problem. But the tree is not the real problem. The real problem is, as you say, is that they believe it's not their problem. Once they start to believe, okay, we have a part in this, we can solve it, then, in fact, the tree is not a problem anymore. It is solved very quickly. So that's fundamental. And it's what you need to understand from, I think, about leadership. It's one fundamental idea to try to understand what's the real challenge for the group. And here, as we say, we can distinguish what Ronald Heifetz from Harvard University calls the technical challenge, the tree. Indeed, it's a challenge. But in fact, it's a technical one, because once you know how to solve it, it can go very quickly. While there is this adaptive challenge, which is here symbolized by the fact that you have all kinds of people just, you know, waiting for something to happen. And basically, the adaptive challenge is the need for them to change their vision of the world. In this case, moving from a vision of the world where this type of problem is not ours to one where they take actively part in solving their own problem. And basically, to cut it very simply, leadership is about mobilizing the group to face its challenges. And that's what we will investigate about this. So there is a scene where you see a guy dropping a helmet. To me, it's a symbol that the guy at the moment is changing his vision of the world. He's letting go something which was blocking his vision of the world at the time. And this change in their vision of the world is what leads to action, which mobilizes people for collective action. Okay. Now, leadership. You've mentioned, yeah, it doesn't matter about age, whatever. Indeed, what is interesting about this little boy, he has no formal authority. And that's a key also thing to recognize. Leadership is not about authority in terms of formal authority, being in charge of something officially. You have tons in this world, tons of CEOs, presidents, sorry, hold on, we need to find something to...
you meant
annulé, et tu annules, ah voilà. So, it's not about formal authority. You have tons of CEOs, presidents, ministers, or whatever, who have a formal authority and no leadership whatsoever. And you have all kinds of people who have no formal authority, they have no title, and they have a lot of leadership. A very good example of this is, for example, Martin Luther King. He had no formal authority. President of nothing, but he just took the leadership in order to promote or to mobilize his people to stand up for their rights. So everybody can be a leader. And the way you become or are a leader is not once and for all and for always. It's just when you take actions in order to mobilize your group. And the next day, you might not be a leader anymore because maybe there is no need to mobilize the group anymore. So for me, leadership is not something you acquire, and when you have acquired it, it's forever with you. No, it's just in function of what you do at a certain moment, or you don't do. So what does it do? And but let's think also, you remember this girl with the yellow scarf? Basically, at some point, she's just sitting around looking, and then by watching this boy, she starts to move and gets really into it. So the question we might ask ourselves is, what made her engage? And what will make you engage in a particular situation? What are the challenges that your group, either this one or friends in which you are befriended with and you form a group, what are the challenges they face? And what's the role you want to have in this group? Likewise, this guy, basically, will you, in front of the challenges of your group, will you stay in your comfort zone and expect others to move? And they might move too late, so that you are collectively, basically, destroyed in one way or another. Or you get out, and like this guy, you start to mobilize the others. So we also need to reflect about something. I don't know if you noticed how the people reacted to the challenge of the tree. What did they do? What did you see?
Some laughed at the beginning.
Some laughed at the beginning. What else? Yes?
A couple started arguing.
They started arguing. What does it mean? Why do they argue?
Maybe the tree represents...
He's a psychologist, yes. The tree represents what?
A problem that they have in their relationship.
Maybe. What else, yes?
Maybe they just don't believe that it can work, and they're like, one is saying, oh, it's going to help, and the other is
it's not worth. Yes.
Like,
so people starting yelling at each other or arguing. What else did you see? In terms of reactions to the problem,
there were some people who were like, oh, this is going to take forever, so I
just take some tea
and wait. Yeah.
Yes. What else did you see? Other reactions? Yes.
The first people who came to help were also children, and they came.
Yes, that's right. What about the others? There is one guy who is just going away. He can call a taxi on the other side of the road and gets away. And he's apparently a very higher up citizen. You notice that? And there are the people also, you know, this guy on this motorbike arguing with another, etc. Why do they do this? Why do they do this, do you think? Think about situations in which your group is basically in front of a challenge.
You shift the blame, or you try to find the responsible other person that you can...
Indeed. What happens is that when a group is facing a challenge, a lot of people will try to escape. And you have many ways to escape. One is to escape literally, going away. Another one is just to say, I sit and wait for the others to do something. It's not my problem. And another one is to start arguing with others. Because basically it unstresses us from the real stress factor. So you move, you shift your attention and the attention of others. So those fights are not real fights. They are just substitute, because people do not want to face the challenge. Okay, it's very important. So it has a clear implication for the role of the leader in that moment. What could it be? What's the role of the leader in such a situation? Yes?
To focus the people's attention to the real problem.
Exactly. How do you do this? You will commit acts that reduces the stress of the people so that they can refocus on the real issue. That's what he does. He doesn't do much, this boy. He doesn't talk, doesn't, you know, say, stop, listen to me. No. He just commits a very symbolic act which somehow modulates the stress of the group, gets their attention to what's really at stake, and helps them focus on it. And basically, by doing something absurd to some extent, he lowers the stress. And that's a key idea. The role of the one of the main role of the leader is not to do something for the sake of doing something, but it's doing something so that the group is able to refocus on the real challenge. Because if you have too much stress, people just freak out, like it happens here. If you have no stress at all, people just, you know, are not moved. But just the right amount of stress will lead people to act purposefully. Think of the application of the theory to the world today. What does it tell you about what's going on, for example, with Trump, Erdogan, and people like them? Are they modulating the stress of the group? What do you think? No. In fact, they hijack the stress for them to grow in importance by making others believe that they can solve the problem for them, and therefore do not really help the group to focus on its problem. And in the meantime, they gain a lot of importance. Think about it. It's exactly what Hitler did in the 1930s. Huge problems in Germany following the First World War. And then you've got this guy coming up and basically saying, you're not the problem, guys. You German citizens, you're not the problem. Jews are the problems. So basically you deflate the blame, indeed, on others in order to modulate the stress, but not in a productive way. Because in the meantime, you don't solve anything. All you do is gaining power for yourself so that people follow you because they want to see their stress level reduced. And so you see this idea of leadership, at least understood as I try to frame it now, is very important to understand what's going on in organizations, private or public, or in society as a whole. Interrupt me if you want to investigate further what I'm saying. So modulating the stress is really primary. Now, what does he do exactly? And we can decompose some of his actions. At first, he discerns and he looks at what's going on. And he tries to understand what's going on in this particular situation. That's what we call discernment. And I think that symbolically, it's not by chance that he's on a bus which is higher up. So he's a better view of the whole situation. That's what a leader or somebody who wants to mobilize the group needs to do, to get a big picture of what's going on and try to understand the different groups. Somebody mentioned the challengers and the supporters. You need to understand what's going on with those. Who can help you to move the group? Who will block you, etc.? That's discernment. And to look at the situation with objectivity is fundamental in this situation. Because if you do it with subjectivity, you color the situation with your own desires, frustrations, or whatever. So you need to take a stand back to look at it as objectively as possible. In order to do this, you need to work upon yourself. You need to know yourself so that you want put on the situation your own vision of the world. Let's say. So to be less driven by your ego. Ego is okay. It becomes a problem when it's so bloated that you color every situation in function of that. Heifetz says you need to get on the balcony. And he means get on the balcony to watch the people dancing on the dance floor. If you are dancing with the others, you cannot see the patterns that those dancers will do together. That's first thing he does. Second, we've seen it, we've said it, courage. And the courage up to the point of absurdity in some occasion doesn't mean that every act of the leader needs to be absurd, but it needs to be shocking so that the people will be basically awakened by that act. Another friend of mine, Mark Strom, says you need to dare to speak into darkness on behalf of others. What does it mean? It means basically that as a leader, you don't need to have a vision of what will happen. To me, that's the vision bullshit. We always say, yeah, the leader needs to have a vision. No, the only vision he needs to have is not the end of the actions that must be taken, but just to be conscious of the challenge and maybe on how to mobilize the others. But the solution to the problems will come from the group, much more than the leader. And in that sense, a leader is somebody who can recognize that he doesn't know where the group is going to go. But at least he dares to speak about it, to name the problem, for example. And he does that not in his own interest, like Trump would do today, because basically all he does is in order to grow his own image before anything else. But he does that on behalf of others, yes.
But how does he modulate the stress of the group if he doesn't give a solution? If he just says...
Look at him. He doesn't give a solution in the sense of he doesn't say this is how we are going to do it. He just does something. It's not a solution yet. He does something that sparkles the movement and the mobilization of the others. He doesn't need, at least it's very clear, he doesn't need to tell a great vision. This is where we're going to go. No, just does something that ignites the movement. Yes? What does he do to, and it's fundamental in whatever position you might have in the future, to dare to go beyond the scope of your authority. If you accept to work only within the boundaries of your authority, that have been defined by somebody else, then nothing will change. You need to challenge those boundaries. Now, the trick is to challenge them without getting killed too quickly. And I mean killed symbolically or not. Okay? So you need to be subtle. Sometimes you will be working like a fox rather than as a lion. But you need to challenge those boundaries. And that's what he does. He's not expected to do something. He's just a schoolboy. The people expected to do something that are the police, firemen, whatever. And symbolically, it's a very strong message. So if the circle is your scope of authority, you need to get out of it. But if you do it too bravely, too quickly, and not very subtly, you might be wiped away. If you do it in a subtle way, you might get far. Basically, if you would have done, you would have come to the policeman and say, guys, what are you doing here? I mean, you should be doing it, etc. He might have got a slap in the face. By doing what he did, didn't blame anybody, but he did something that was not in his, basically, scope of authority. Conversation and care. Showing care for the people, for the group, even for those who don't do anything. That's very, very important. And on top of that, doing it without saying a word, just by acting, by looking in a friendly way to those who come to help, by not blaming the others. let me share with you something important I just discovered. It's a Burkina video. I don't have it here, but basically, what they say, they talk about. Let me do it here. They talk about the way we can help a group of people, society, organization, to change. And they talk about two curves. One is this one, and this one. This is the way things are going in the classical way. For example, our carbon-fueled society. It has gone up, and now we see it's going to go down because it's not sustainable, right? So some people think we are there, some other there, whatever, but we know it's going to go down. And the more we wait, the more difficult it is. In the meantime, we have some people who are conscious that we need to change. And they are getting organized, okay? In the beginning, it's very difficult. And that's probably where we are today. The movements who fight for, or let's say, who try to promote a different way of living, a different economy, are in this situation, okay? And that's why it's very difficult for those who are still in the classical model to jump into the bandwagon of the future. So basically, we need to help them make the jump, to move maybe at this point. And for this, we need to support them. Basically, we cannot really blame them all the time. But we need to help them find and see other solutions and other ways of looking at the world. Anyway, I will send you the link to the Burkina Institute video, which explains this in more detail. Now, so conversation and care, fundamental. I like also what Strom is saying by renewing the key missing conversation. What does it mean? In any group, organization, public or private, in any society, there is a key conversation which people do not dare to address. Some organization, it might be the discrepancy between the top salaries and the rest, or it might be the fact that the organization is basically selling a product which is not sustainable for society, or whatever. As long as there is not a sense of freedom within the organization to address those topics in a serious way, then it's very difficult to change things. And in a way, what's remarkable with this boy is that he does address this conversation without saying a word, just by acting. Protection of the weakest. That's what he does. In any change situation, there will be people will suffer from the change. There will be, and you need to make sure that you embark them on the change and that they will have the hope of benefiting of the change. It's very, very important to get a feeling of solidarity of among the people who embark on a change project. But it's also important because most often, the weakest are the ones who feel first what's going wrong with a particular situation. And you need to listen to them carefully. Think of the canaries in the mines. Those yellow canaries in the mines. They are just like the weakest in a group. They're very small, they're very weak. They are the first one smelling there is a problem down in the mine. You need to be able to listen to them. So you need to protect them. Not only to basically embark them positively in the change, but also by listening to what they have to say about the current situation. Humility. You have remarked that it was an important topic, humility. And I think, besides the fact that he doesn't, you know, play the big boy, and especially at the end, he goes back to his place, he claps with the others, he doesn't expect to be, you know, honored or whatever. No, he's just done his work and he moves on to something else. It's not new. 2600 before Christ, Lao Tzu was already saying the best leader is the one, the group, whose existence the group barely knows. That the real leader is never somebody who shows off, somebody who acts, and on behalf of the group. The rest comes naturally, basically. And in order to do this, to have this humility, you need again to work upon yourself, to find an inner calm which helps you to mobilize the group, to act with confidence, and, as I said, to modulate the stress of the rest. By being serene within yourself, you can radiate a confidence that would help also the group to find its own calm. Jacques Casterman, another friend, says, I believe, something very important. We only suffer from ignoring what is not lacking in a peace. What he means with this is that peace is always within us. Sometimes we try to find it by looking for it through all kinds of activities or meditation, yoga, etc., which is fine. But the inner peace is already there. All we do is through those activities is to find it back and to be able to listen to it. Strom says again, to lead wisely is to pay attention to the very ordinary yet difficult human phenomenon of how a person comes to the fore in one context and gets behind someone else in another. Once again, to be a leader at some point doesn't mean you always need to be the leader. Everybody needs to play a role at some point. The real leader is the one who knows when he comes forward and when he needs to stay in the back. We will see later on that Les Entreprises Libérées or Freedom Inc. or Liberating Organizations, etc., it's all about that. The disciplines are needed in order to get to the point of being able to act like that. Heifetz categorized them in four big categories of disciplines. One, the capacity to diagnose the system, to understand what's going on, to get on the balcony, understand the different alliances you need to find with people who are with you, others who are against, etc. Secondly, is to mobilize the system, to basically act in a way that people will be triggered to act themselves. These are basically the external type of actions you need to perform. But in order to do this, you need to see yourself as a system or as part of a bigger system. Not considering yourself as just an individual disconnected from the rest. I think on this Oriental philosophies, whether from India or Japan or China, have a lot to teach us. And finally, find the ways to deploy yourself, to become able to play that role when it's necessary. So the question now is, what makes you want to mobilize yourself and others and to have the capacity and liberty to do so? We won't, you know, discuss this now because it would take us too much time, but this is one of the questions I would like to leave you with. Now, let's move to the second part, if you're not too tired yet, to the second part of the presentation, which is about the liberating organizations. I've been basically trying to apply those principles for the last 15 years, whether in a bank where I was leading a commercial department, or in the ministry, and most recently in a smaller organization. So I will try to share with you what does it mean, why it's important, and how basically we did it. Before that, do you know the Gallup results? Do you know what Gallup is?
No.
Yeah, some of you do. Some of, basically, they make surveys worldwide to try to understand whether people are engaged or not within their organizations. The results are pathetic. This is for Europe. They find out that, on average, only 8% of a particular of the persons within a particular organizations are really engaged. 77% are not engaged. Means basically they wait for orders. But 15% are actively disengaged. What does it mean? That they don't just come to wait for something to happen at work. They come to sabotage the work of others because they are frustrated, because they think life is unfair, they've not been promoted as they should, or the boss sucks, or the strategy is bullshit, whatever. It's 15%. If you translate this into this type of bike, 10 people on a bike, it would mean that you have just one person pedaling forward, you have six pretending they are pedaling, and there are three who are using the brakes as much as they can. You can imagine that an organization cannot move forward very fast. But that's the reality of a lot of organizations today. So fundamentally, we need to ask ourselves, what makes people act this way or being so disengaged in a lot of organizations? And you can find some explanations when we look at Will Schutz, for example, a psychologist in America in the 80s, who wrote some very good books about what he calls the human element. What makes people, you know, engage themselves in a particular situation? And basically, what he says is self-esteem. Self-esteem is the key concept for him to solving organizational problems. It's very strange. It's not something we talk a lot about in most of our organizations. How do we foster, sustain, help people to develop a good self-esteem? And he says, if we want to improve team performance, we must work on individuals. Okay, so what does it mean? Basically, he says, well-being at work and teamwork requires us to address individuals' fear of being insignificant, which means that we need to include them. Secondly, not liked, not appreciated, which means we need to work on openness, not just to include them, but make them feel that we are really interested in them. And also, they fear to be incompetent, to be rejected, because we would consider they are not performing well, etc. And there we need to help them with the control lever, which means the impact people can have on a particular situation. Yes?
I would just like to make a comment and yes. To ask your opinion on this one. When you're talking about all these things, for me it just pops up Japan as an example where mm-hmm. the teamwork is meant to be very strong and it mm-hmm. seems to work there, and there are like loads of business styles there. And this seems to be oriented very much to the Western cultures where individual is like me, and it's not we.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you do in the international games once you have different cultures of me and we?
Look, it's a good question, but I think it's a little too black and white.
Mm-hmm.
At least, and I do believe so, what Schutz is showing are no fears that are common to any individual, any person, in any society, in any culture. Of course, in the Oriental organizations, let's say, you have the importance of closeness and relations between people is much more important than in the individualistic societies in the West. But fundamentally, even then, those levers, those fears are universal. So there might be differences in terms of intensity, but not as a fundamental concept. At least that's what I believe. So therefore, by addressing those fears, maybe there will be slightly different in, let's say, Japan than in France, but still you will find same ways to try to deal with them. And by the way, I think there are also problems related to, let's say, the Japanese way of doing things in terms of organization. It leads also to some, you know, feeling of lack of freedom from the different individuals in some cases. So it's not just, you know, perfectly black or white. Another guy who has written extensively about those ideas is Douglas MacGregor. Do you know him? Never heard? Okay, he's a very important guy because he's also one of the most inspiring thinker of the whole movement of liberating organizations. Okay, basically, when a lot of, let's say, liberating leaders are referring to their source of inspiration, they will name MacGregor. And MacGregor, in the 60s, wrote a book which is called The Human Side of Enterprise, in which he said, basically, there are two theories of the way people function in organization. Theory X and theory Y. And both are basically two different vision of people at work. Theory X, what does it say? It says that basically people are lazy and they don't want to work. So, in order to make them work in an organization, you need carrots and sticks. Carrots, promotions, higher salaries, and so on. Or sticks, fear of being fired, etc. Those are what we call extrinsic motivators. Motivators which are outside the person. Theory Y says just the opposite. It says that within a particular environment and under specific circumstances, people want naturally to do a good job, want to give the best of themselves. And therefore, what will motivate them are not extrinsic motivators, but intrinsic motivators. For example, and this relates to the fears I mentioned earlier, what we seek, basically, by doing a good job, is to give meaning to our existence, to be recognized by the others for doing a good job, to be included in a group and sharing with them the activities that lead to something meaningful. So fundamentally, the leaders or managers who try to implement self-governing organizations are people who are convinced that theory Y is a better vision of the people at work than theory X. Right? And they, yes?
Isn't it never a combination of both?
It's a good question. It's more difficult than that, just combining the both. You know, you could say that, for example, theory Y implies that you fundamentally believe that people are good by nature and that you need to trust them. And that by trusting them, they will be in a situation where they will give their best. Now, having said that, you can also appreciate the fact that some people will want to abuse that situation. And therefore, you will also recognize that and put in place mechanisms that will limit the negative impact of those people. But we'll come back to that later if you want. Okay, but I wouldn't say it's a combination of both. But indeed, to adopt theory Y doesn't mean you blindfully say that everybody's good and you just trust them. Okay, it's more complex than that. Yes?
When you hear talk about better, what are you referring to? Organizations that perform better?
No.
Or
better in the sense of, let's say, helping people to feel better, to deploy themselves better, to reduce their fears, etc.
So it refers to the engagement.
Yes,
and
exactly.
The numbers.
Exactly. We will see later on, it's a good question, that it might have also an impact on performance. But the paradox is that you cannot try to play on fears, etc., only
or with the ultimate objective of improving performance. Because if you do so, indirectly, you will reinforce fears. See? So you need to really work for the sake of the people, and this will indirectly lead to better performance. But performance might never be the ultimate objective.
Otherwise, you just kill it, basically. Yes? Now,
Desi and Ryan were two very important psychologists. They've also worked on this more recently. And basically, they say that well-being and performance at work are basically the result of a combination of people being able to use their competencies, to feel socially included, and to have a certain degree of autonomy.
Okay. Now, I come to the core of the current thinkers basically developing their ways of managing an organization as inspired by people like McGregor, Desi and Ryan, or Schutz. And two of the most prominent thinkers are Frédéric Laloux and Isaac Goetz. Do you know any of them? No? Just you do? That's it? Nobody else? Okay, that's good. So I recommend you really to read their books or look for their articles or videos on the web. Goetz, Freedom Inc., in French, Les Entreprises Libérées. Laloux, Reinventing Organizations. In French, the book is also called Reinventing Organizations. In both cases, there are, let's say, cartoons version of it, which can be also very, very interesting. And as I said, a lot of videos. Basically, what is interesting is that the main principles they share are closely related to the ones I mentioned by Schultz. Inclusion, well, the way it is translated in Goetz and Laloux's words is by respecting people as intrinsically equal within the organization. And secondly, especially for Laloux, he talks about wholeness, to take the person as a whole and not just as a factor of production, to respect the person as a whole person. Control, well, basically translated into their jargon, is self-direction. To create a culture in which people can take a lot of initiatives, do not need to refer systematically to bosses and the like. And thirdly, openness, well, putting focus on the personal growth of each person within the organization, and also, especially in the case of Laloux, to consider the organization as a living organism and not just as a mechanic. And so therefore to pay attention to the evolutionary purpose of the organization. Now, let's try now to understand what it may mean practically within an organization. And I will share with you here my own experience plus the ones of other companies. Before that, I need to mention also that there are some surveys which are done currently on the impact of those self-governing organizations. And one which is very interesting is by Dov Seidman from LRN, which is a consultancy in the States, but they are performing surveys across the world. And they've published recently, in 2016, the How report. As it says, a global empirical analysis of how governance, culture, and leadership impact performance. So you can find it easily on the web. I will also share with you some of the results of this survey. So let's start with the first principle, respect and wholeness. Basically, I see three ways of making sure this principle is respected within the organization. First is why way. We'll explain what it means. Second is humility. And third is fairness. Now, the why way, it comes from somebody who is a very respected leader in that sense, Ricardo Semler. Have you heard about him, Ricardo Semler? No. Ricardo Semler from Semco, a Brazilian company, has been a pioneer in self-governing management. And basically the Wai Wei, it means that you create a culture in which people feel they can say whatever they want about the organization to whoever they want. They can criticize, they can make suggestions. Basically, they feel free to speak up. Remember what I said about the missing conversation. In a self-governing organization, which is really well in that sense, the missing conversation are directly addressed so that they do not block people in their daily work. So how did we do this at the ministry? Basically, we developed the strategy, the management plan I needed to produce with the whole ministry. Basically, I invited the 1,100 people working for the ministry to participate in that exercise. Of course, not the 1,100 did volunteer for it, but at least 100 did. And with those, we developed the plan. What was interesting is that we had in those 100 people at all levels within the organization, including people, you know, in some cases, cleaning the toilets, invited to discuss with the director generals about the objectives we wanted to have for this ministry. We did that, and we produced herewith a good document, at least, but at least objectives that could be shared with everybody within the organization. Second thing we did in order to create this Wai Wei culture, it's to have a different working of the management committee. And it went into different stages. For example, first, well, we were meeting every Monday with the director generals to define on what we should decide on this or that. But the people, the staff, was not informed about what we were basically discussing. Only once in a while we said, okay, we have made this decision and it will be applied this and this way. What we started to do first is to communicate to the whole staff the agenda of the management committee, and also to give them direct feedback to all of them on what we had decided together. I know it's hot and some of you are getting sleepy, so if you want to open the window, maybe it might help some. But that was not enough. The next stage was to allow people to make suggestions on the agenda of the management committee. So we got, you know, feedback from people saying, you should discuss this topic. The last stage was to invite everybody to participate in the management committee. Once again, not 1,100 people came to the management committee, but every Monday morning we had different people coming in function of the topics addressed by the management committee to discuss them with us. These are just two examples on how you embark the whole organization to feel included, to feel respected, and to be able to share their own views on what should be done in order to improve the way we work together. What we did also is to move to flex desk, but not just for some people and not for others, for everybody. That's the idea of fairness. So basically we just tore down all the walls and we moved into flex desk. Before that, I had myself a huge, huge office. It was torn down so that it would become also an open space for the whole team. And I did not have, just like the director generals, any closed office. It might seem strange for some, but if well implemented, if discussed with the team, those new offices are much more stimulating for everybody. Yes?
But then how would you do, for example, for like confidential calls?
You multiply the number of meeting rooms. Also, isolation rooms for people who need at some point to work, you know, very and concentrate themselves on a particular subject. But these are not assigned rooms. See? And you define also all kinds of spaces which help people to meet, but also to work more peacefully at some point. And you combine this with all other measures which I will explain.
Okay.
We also changed the composition of the executive committee, management committee. We had, when I arrived, we had one woman and seven men. We moved to 4-4. Not because I only wanted, you know, I wanted more women in the team, but because it gave a better balance within the team. The yin and the yang, you know, I mean, it's really important in that sense, and to have those balances of the two. I would like to mention also a few examples from Gore, because the ministry, we did some things, but we could not go as far as some other organizations like Gore have gone. But you had a question.
Yes, I had a question regarding the composition of the executive committee,
yes.
Bringing more women into
mm-hmm.
the team. How did you handle not this recomposition, not to incentivize just filling a seat?
Mm-hmm.
Just like
bringing, absolutely.
If you only have five women in the whole company, then you, by default, four of them are going to be there. How do you handle not...
Well, I mean, first of all, I need to say, and this relates to one other question, which is, you know, how you make sure you have in your team challengers and supporters and so on. Well, very clearly, when I started my mission as president of the ministry, I realized that the current, or the then management committee was not at all in favor of this approach, and that it would be very difficult for me to move into that direction with that team. And you know, that's where you need to be conscious that it will not be always easy. So basically, I felt that I needed to change quite drastically the composition of the committee. And basically, I changed seven out of eight, six out of seven members. And basically, they were replaced by people who emerged quite naturally from the ministry as being the one supported by the rest of the staff. And it happens that most of them were women. So it was not a choice of I want more women. It was just who are the people who are naturally supported by the rest of the group.
Mm-hmm. Because my next question was that they at one point questioned the fact that those people were sitting in the executive committee. Meaning, they are there just because they are a woman and they need a woman.
No,
in
that
the,
was not at all
the
case.
Like
no.
Trying to fill quotas.
No, that's why I'm not for quotas, because it leads to exactly what you said. But if you basically say we want to have people who are supported by the rest of the staff and who can relate to those principles I mentioned before, then I think naturally you get more women. Because they are more receptive to those principles in general. They are less, let's say, obsessed by the symbols of power than men are in general. And that's why they can also relate better to those type of organizations. Yes?
How long did that transition take? And then, I guess,
well,
how did the people who were displaced, like, weren't they resentful?
Okay.
Yes.
Yes. Well, in the public sector, as you know, you don't fire people. You just move them somewhere else.
Yeah.
So nobody was fired. Some chose, let's say, deliberately to move to another ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Others were basically gently invited to do so and accepted to take early retirement. And others resisted. But that's where you need to use ways of getting what needs to be done. And in my case, it was basically an audit of their ways of working made by some service within the ministry, which clearly showed that they were not managing properly their organization or their director general. And basically then it led to a, let's say, forceful discussion between them and myself, which resulted in all those cases in their either early retirement or move to another organization. And of course some people will say yes, but it's totally contradictory with participative management.
there you need to distinguish two levels. You cannot allow some people in very high position to hijack all the process in order to basically to continue and to enjoy their powers, but despite of others or against others. And there you need to basically to get them out one way or another.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you can't, if you're not doing a good job, you don't get to keep your position just because of seniority. Like, you have to...
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that's the way it worked in and still works in a lot of public organizations.
I was wondering if some of them expressed the willingness to change, or...
Well, some did, and those we helped to move forward.
Yeah.
But in the case of the management committee, no. And even if they would have expressed it, I knew it was not very sincere.
But it feels like they real cause troubles in other ministers now. Like they would do trouble.
In that sense, you're right. That's why at the other levels, you cannot be, of course, as drastic. And for example, we had some people, like in any ministry, who were really making the life of others miserable. And basically, we stopped this moving away those people in other departments. Basically, what we did is I took them directly with me, close to me, and by doing so, to some extent, they were neutralized, and in some cases, they really evolved for the better. Not because it was me, but because, in a way, for the first time, they were recognized as important person, and this was sometimes the trick for them to change. Yes?
Yeah, just small one. Because isn't with the manager position, in a way, when someone new comes in charge, those are sort of political positions. They change all the time. I mean, no, I don't know how it works there, but there are certain positions, the ones that I guess you mentioned, they usually change. Because you have to trust the people that are in charge of
mm-hmm.
each of the divisions within the ministry itself.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the question?
No, my question is that is the usual case in Belgium, is it that they always stayed in those positions,
yes.
or with the new government
it's
they changed?
No, it's complex. Maybe it would take us too much time, but basically we have what we call the normal management, and there they move through years, basically, and selection procedures within the ministry. And then you have what we call top management, which are basically the president and the director generals. And those are selected by a special jury. And there you can have people coming from the private sector, like I did, or people coming from the administration itself. Mm-hmm. And they are usually appointed for a certain number of years, which is usually 5 years, 5 to 6 years. But in the case of the director generals, they are mainly, most of the time, renewed kind of automatically,
mm-hmm.
which leads to problems, basically. Yes.
Well, I often heard this critique about entreprise and participative management, where basically you are much more monitored than you used to be in a normal enterprise, and also because everyone can be involved in basically everything.
Yes.
You have
yes.
experts which has been working on a specific topic for like 20 years, and they see their work being challenged and managed by
yes.
people that. Don't have a clue
about it,
and what do you respond to that?
Okay,
it's not for you.
No. Maybe you will get some answers from
that.
What follows, right? But in a nutshell, yes, indeed, when you move to a more participative management, you have some kind of a social control by everybody of what the others are doing. And in that sense, it can be considered by some, especially unions and so on, like more controls. But it's just like when you go on a holiday with your friends and you decide on some collective rules. If somebody does not respect them, then I guess if you're true friends, the rest of the people will tell him or her, look, you don't respect the rules that we agreed upon. So either you change or you get out. And that's the type of changes that you make. But to me, this is much better than having some person higher up making sure you apply rules that you have not participated in designing. But indeed, there is a form of control which can be very drastic. So you shouldn't consider that les entreprises libérées are just places where people do whatever they want. No, they do what they've collectively decided to do. But once they've done that, the enforcement of it can be very, very, very strong.
Can you instigate possibility of management if you're not actually in the management team? Is there a way to do it?
It's very difficult. I mean, you can do it within your business unit, but of course you will be limited by the rules that are imposed on you by people higher up. So your possibility to free your business unit will be limited. But it's possible. That's what I did within the bank. So it's possible. But it's less strong, of course, than if the top boss really wants to push for that type of management.
And what do you suggest? What happens if actually your boss is completely
against
not responsive to this and he goes against it?
Well, I would suggest that you don't tell him that you are trying to do it. You do it nevertheless. And if it works, then later on he probably will be supportive of you because it works. And if it doesn't work, you might be fired. At least you will have tried. And you will try it somewhere else. You can only do this if you are truly believing it's the only way you want to manage a team. If you're not utterly convinced in your guts that's the best and only way to do it, then don't even think about it. As I would say, it's not for sissy. I mean, it's really something where you go for it or you don't. Because the obstacles to it are huge. The whole culture within our society to today is fundamentally against it. Although things are moving, as I mentioned here, there are people trying to change, but a lot of people are not at all receptive to this idea. And once again, as I said, it can only start when the leader or the manager of the business unit, or even better, of the top organization, is undergone a transformation, an inner transformation, where, for example, to earn so much more than your colleagues is not important for your self-image, for your self-esteem. Where to have 3 windows instead of 1 is not essential to your mental well-being. You know, those kind of things. Unfortunately, it's still the case in many organizations. People are fighting, dying to have 3 windows or to have a car of that level rather than another one. When you are still in those trip, then you cannot start with this approach of management. Now, just to illustrate this, when you think about Gore-Tex, you know? Gore is a very successful company. They've been founded by Bill Gore and his wife in 1958. There are today 10,000 people. They've grown every year with more than 10%. And they work with a very, very special culture. In this culture, there are no given assignments. So nobody tells you should do this or that. You find it out for yourself. When you are recruited at Gore, you are not told you will be recruited to do this or that. You will find it for yourself. And you have all the time in the world to do it. There are no ranks and titles. If you are a salesperson, and you go and see a vice president of another company, you put on your guide card, vice president. And if you go and see a president, you put on your card, president. Nobody cares within Gore whatever you put on your card. You don't care. All are associates. So when you do this, basically, when you create a Y-way culture, humility, fairness, everybody wants to take initiative. And when you look at the whole report, what it shows is that when basically you make sure those
those principles are respected, people are five times more authentically dedicated to their job. They are more deeply accountable and more deeply responsible. I know I need to rush because what time do we start? 40. Okay, so 20 minutes, and we need to answer all those questions. I know that in the meantime we have, I hope, already answered quite a lot of them. Personal growth and evolutionary purpose. What does it mean? Exploration, craftsmanship, and collaboration. So, exploration, it's basically giving the capacity and the opportunity to people to experience different types of jobs within the organization and different types of trainings, and not just the trainings defined by the HR people. So basically, what we did is we scrapped the usual list of trainings and we told people, tell us the type of trainings you want to have. Anybody could propose different types of trainings. And at GORE, basically, they apply something which I did not formally apply within the ministry, but which I like very much, is to make sure that basically the task of HR is to help every person within the organization to find what they call the sweet spot, which is meeting the meeting point between the ability of the person, the relevance of the activity for the company, and the enjoyment the person has in doing that activity. That's a sweet spot. And basically, okay, it's not like everybody finds it right away, but you try to make sure people can look for it and find it within the organization. And mind you, it's not like you would say, yeah, but everybody will want to do the same thing and there are some cores that will be left behind. No. When you have a real and well managed organization in this sense, people basically share the tasks, the goods and the less interesting ones in a very, very interesting way, but on a free way. Yes?
You talk about fairness at one point, but you also talked about people wanting an office of a certain size or a car of a certain rank. I'm wondering about salaries. Mm-hmm. When you talk about this sweet spot, basically,
yeah,
there is no money in
yeah.
there.
Look, I know. Yes, go.
Just
go.
Do you think it's okay to pay people based on their sensitivity to salary and not based on how they compare to other people, like benchmarking or seniority or whatever?
I can share with you the experience because I could not do this in the,
no,
probably, in the ministry.
Yeah.
But, for example, took Morningstar in the States, one of the biggest tomato producing companies in the States and therefore in the world. They work like this. Every year, each person sends a brief to the CEO saying, I want to be raised by so much because I've done this and this. And basically, all the requests are met. The only thing is that those briefs are public within the company. So, talking about social control, that's the kind of things that happen. Other example, at Decathlon in Belgium, where they are really quite advanced with this. Every year also, they meet in order to discuss the promotions and the raise in salaries of the members of the team. They do this together. The whole team says, okay, everybody presents, I think I should earn this more for this and that. And basically the group collectively agrees. And if somebody says, I don't respect what has been said in the group and asks for more, it will be given to that person. But typically what has happened recently, somebody did not respect the rules, basically what was agreed by the group, asked for more, received it, which led to troubles, tensions within the team, and finally, by discussing those tensions, the person reviewed downwards her a request for more salary. So it goes very far, right? At GORE, it's slightly different. Every person within the company is a godfather or godmother who will, at the end of each year, present to a group of persons within the company
what the person has achieved and what he believes should be accorded as a growth in salary or whatever. And those group of people will decide. It will not be the boss or whatever will decide for them. So, but as you imagine, all this requires a degree in maturity of the company, which is far higher than most of the companies today. Yeah, I just mentioned briefly, we put in place some special trainings which did not exist before in the ministry in order to promote all this. For example, self-knowledge. For example, at Decathlon, I just participated into some trainings for their people, which is really about self-knowledge, and which is incredible. And they spend 9 days each year on those type of trainings. Things that do not lead to nothing directly in terms of productivity or performance, just knowing yourself better. And their only interest is knowing yourself better. It's part of what we should be able to do within an organization. I told you about craftsmanship. Why do I believe this is so important? It's to get away from this craziness we have today in our world and in many organizations about performance and productivity and how it can backfire. And I think in that sense, craftsmanship at Bürgsorg is a wonderful example. Bürgsorg is a company in the Netherlands of nurses that go at home of the people to treat them. Okay, in those companies, what happens is that the nurses are told, you have 2 minutes to do this type of injections. You have 3 minutes to do, typically like many people in other organizations. It leads, of course, to a bad feeling from the nurses who do not have always the time to treat well their patients. Patients themselves do not feel to be treated as humans, etc. So what did people at Bürgsorg say? They said, now, you nurses, you know better how to treat well your patients. And that's the most important thing. So you take the time you need. Now, the incredible thing is that it led, and it's not so incredible afterwards, it led to the following. Nurses took their time, not only to treat the patients well, but also to think creatively about how their patients could recover more quickly their health. And when you treat those patients, most of them are senior people who have lost contact with their neighbors, who are feeling isolated, and basically their illness is related to that isolation. So they started not just to do injections, but also to talk with the neighbors and say, would you be willing to take care also of this lady, or this old lady, etc.? The result of all this is that, in fact, the speed of the recovery of the patients treated by Bürgsorg nurses are much faster than the other ones. As a result, in fact, the government in the Netherlands realized that it was much more effective, much more efficient to treat patients this way. And for Bürgsorg itself, it is also beneficial because their patients are treated well, their nurses are feeling happy, and in fact they earn more money because of the way they are paid by the government, which is related also to the length of treatment. In fact, they also earn more money. Today, while they've been created in 2006, Bürgsorg employed 10,000 nurses. To me, it's an example, and I've experienced just the same within the ministry or the bank. Allow for people to do their job in a good way, to take the time to do it well, with love, with care, and what you lose as direct or apparent productivity will be gained in some other way. If you trust really the fact that people are willing to do well. Collaboration. There, the focus is on having teams which are small enough so that people know each other. In big companies, this is one of the main problems. People do not know each other. And so they have to rely on strict rules, compliance,
processes, etc., to work well together. And therefore, Robin Dunbar, a psychologist, says 150 people is the maximum number of people you can know and you can care for personally within a team. You can not have more than 150 people. And that's why exactly you have always business units with their own P&L, which is no bigger than 150 people. So when you do this exploration, craftsmanship, collaboration, basically people not only want to take initiatives, they are also able to do so. And when you look at the whole report, 8 times more long-term orientation, 6 times more resilient, and 8 times better decision-making. Because people feel, again, able to collaborate, to do their job well, and not just being pressed by productivity measures. Self-direction, to conclude, is basically to trust people as adults, to make them feel responsible, to link freedom with responsibility, and basically to support them instead of controlling them. And it means for the management to let go. So what does it mean? I mentioned we moved into flex desk for all. That was the criteria of fairness. But we combined this with different measures, like allowing people to work whenever they want and suppressing the obligation to clock in and to clock out. And it's not just suppressing clocking or clock out, it's the obligation. So people wanted to stay in the clocking and clock out system were able to do so. This was handy in order to gain the support of the unions, but it was also a way to show the respect for people, some willing to keep the clock in and clock out and make their calculations, I need so many hours more, and others to move away from it. Teleworking also, up to 3 days a week. Now, all this was allowed, but at the same time, we ask people to define the way they would work with that within each team. Because if you allow everybody to choose their days of teleworking, you will have most of them taking the Wednesday, and nobody will be in the office on Wednesday. So basically, you need also to have a collective responsibility whereby people say, OK, we cannot be all away on Wednesday, so who will stay on Wednesday? Maybe find a rotation system or whatever. What is important is to define collectively the rules, to define the objectives, to commit to it, and enjoy the freedom that goes with it. But it's not just one without the other. Freedom and responsibility are closely linked. Cloud computing, moving to cloud computing was also important for us, and we were the first ministry to do so. Now, in order to promote this idea of treating people as adults, it's not just by suppressing the obligation to clock in and clock out. Because I think it's important to realize that if you treat people as infants, they will behave as infants. If you treat them as adults, they will want to be, let's say, worthy of that confidence. So what you do in terms of decision-making process, you can adopt processes like sociocratic processes. Do you know them, sociocratic processes? No. Well, look at it on the web. You will find ways to do so which are very structured. And basically, sociocratic processes are ways to allow people to express themselves in a very orderly way, but ensuring hereby that everybody can voice his opinion, that it is taken into account, and that you go basically, you do the discussion until everybody fundamentally has no objection to the decision the group is taking. It's very efficient. At the beginning, it takes more time than having somebody to decide what to do. But after a while, it is much more effective. First of all, it goes fast. But secondly, everybody is committed to the decision and not just the one who imposed it. You can have, likewise, elections without candidates. It's a very powerful way also to find or to decide
the manager, let's say, of the unit. You gather the team, and basically everybody propose a candidate. And then you work and find out the candidate who has the support of all the team. Another way, which is, it's not another way, a complementary way to make decisions and to take initiatives, is what they do at Gore and in many companies, is what they call the floating line and the advice process. What it means is that basically you say that anybody can take any decision without the approval of a superior as long as this decision is not likely to sink the company. But there is one condition. Any decision taken by anybody needs to be based on the advice process. And the advice process means that the person who wants to take a decision will check with the persons impacted by the potential decision their own ideas and advice. And also look for the advice of experts in that sector or of the decision. And based on that, anybody can take the decision. Yes?
Who defines what mistakes can potentially be?
That you decide collectively within the organization. The way it may take, you know, it might be at different levels, it might be collectively, depending on the size of the company. But yes, it will be decided. And it's very easy to do fundamentally. There are very few, you know, decisions that are likely to sink the company. Another one is the Comité des Petits Cailloux. It's very simple, but basically the idea is that many workers in any organizations have irritants within their daily routines. And those irritants are not taken into account by management. So le Comité des Petits Cailloux is this. Anybody who has a suggestion to resolve those irritants can make it to anybody within the hierarchy. And if he or she does not receive an answer to this proposal within 1 week or 2 weeks, the proposal is automatically adopted. So it puts a lot of pressure on middle management, who does not react or care for the problems of the people, to act more forcefully. Zobrist, well-known figure in this world, says, the one who knows is the one who does. The boss is the one who's got the ball. Which means the people who really know about their job are the ones doing it, and not the managers. So it's, again, the idea of humility, and that's why you let them decide as much as possible. And management is only there to support them, to remove all the obstacles for those people to take the decisions. To do this, basically what happens is that people not only want, are able to take initiatives, but they have also the liberty to do so. 32 times more risk-taking, 11 times more innovation, 6 times more performance. But once again, it's not the performance that matters. It's the well-being of the people that you try to promote through those let's say, processes and principles. Basically, what it led to, and I'm almost finished, I know the time is, quality increase in services, speed increase in dealing with files, fall in absenteeism and long-term sick leave, and yearly savings through the move to FlexDesk, which were quite important too. What Berzok have told you already about, the assignments also, I will move to this, just changing on this, finalizing it with this. What you need in order to make those change happen, beyond all the practical things I mentioned to you, a true, authentic posture change from the management. If they keep on with the same posture, it doesn't work. Act rather than words, remember the little boy, to fill in what we call the trust bucket. Every day you need to make people feel they can trust you and that you trust them. And imagine it's a huge bucket and you fill in with a little teaspoon every day. Coherency at all levels and pilots with opt-outs, like suppressing the clocking in, but the obligation of clocking in or clocking out. So in a nutshell, this is what I wanted to share. I know I am beyond my time. I hope I have answered most of your questions. If I did not, please feel free to send me a mail to call me so that we can discuss it further. I know we have a motorbike waiting for us, so we cannot really have more time dedicated to question and answers, and I'm sorry for that. But really, I'm ready to answer them all by mail or by phone.
Are we going to receive your presentation?
Yes, we can send it through. Yes, for Holland. Yes. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Maybe we can take a picture of all those questions.
Ouais. N'oubliez pas votre chargeur.
But then we always I was extremely like this small decision after this moment and then
but it was useful to see
it was like that I would be fine with everyone else.
Ça c'est à toi, mais pas à moi.
Everyone wants to.